Accession number 19049, Reel 3.
Malcolm Connolly, Reel 3.
Yeah, the facts of these old soldiers, I mean, and some of the stories they would tell us about loose wallers and all that sort of thing didn't make us feel all that brave. But we were given a task of clearing this big desert of rocks, laying out road. We had the task of clearing the rocks, and it was a very barren, arid sort of place. The only thing, there was a canal running almost parallel with the camp that we were going to erect, a very fast flowing canal, which was the only source of enjoyment we would have at that particular place. We created roads. I say created roads. We marked out roads with rocks, which of course the army eventually whitewashed. And we awaited the arrival of the regiment from Selkirk. Once again, we went down to Nowra Station with Indian buses, but not for them to march back. They had sufficient Indian buses and so forth to take their all their kit, and also to take all the personnel back to the camp. Most of these were real old soldiers, because these two regiments, the 25th Dragoons and 26th Hussars, in 1941, it was decided there was a lack of armoured regiments, and so county regiments like the Hampshires and the Lancashires and all the rest of it formed one new armoured regiment, and they bore the title of Royal Armoured Corps. We had one that came eventually with us into Burma, who were the Gordon Highlanders, the 116 Royal Armoured Corps. The cavalry then was, of course, outnumbered by all these regiments of infantry battalions, guards, and so forth, that pressure was put to bear on the authorities to create new cavalry regiments. And so in 1941, six new armoured regiments were created, all bearing outdated military history, from the 22nd Dragoons, 23rd Hussars, 24th Lancers, 25th Dragoons, 26th Hussars, and the 27th Lancers. Four of them were created in the Far East, in India, and the other four were created in the UK. And the system they used for creating these armoured regiments was that NCOs and officers would be taken from regular cavalry regiments. And but the men in the United Kingdom come straight from Royal Armoured Corps training regiments. But in India, there was no such thing as Royal Armoured Corps training regiments. And there was a demand for young men in the Middle East, which was at its height. And so they put a call out in India for men from infantry battalions to transfer to these two new armoured regiments. The officers and NCOs came, in the case of the 26th Hussar, came from the 1420th King's Hussars, and in the 25th Dragoons, they came from the 3rd Carbineers. But most of the men came from infantry battalions. And in time of war, commanding officers don't get rid of their best men, they get rid of their worst. And so these two armoured regiments in India had a motley collection of men who couldn't have cared less. And eventually, they were returned home because most of them were time expired anyway. They'd all done 7 years plus. But they arrived in Nowra camp, and they didn't like us at all. They immediately showed their dislike to us wartime people, because we, as young soldiers, had been used to and accepted the petty disciplines of the army, standing to attention to a lance corporal and so forth and so on, which they wouldn't do. They didn't want to do it. They didn't do it. And what? How could they punish them? Send them home? I doubtful. But anyway, eventually, these men were sent home because they brought in a system in India called Python. And Python was the length of service that a man could do in India. And that started at 7 years. People with 7 years plus were considered to be sent home. And they were gradually replaced by men from Royal Armoured Corps training regiments and volunteers from other armoured regiments. We had no equipment. We had 50 rifles per squadron. We had three 1,500 weights and three 3-tonners. And that was the sole equipment of these armoured regiments. And you can well imagine to us young men who had volunteered or were conscripted into the services, who had been through Britain's most advanced training regiments, Royal Armoured Corps training regiments, to come to a place where they had no tanks, just these few rifles. They were still marching in fours, where we had been trained to march in threes. But eventually all this stopped. They got a few tanks, and they were very, very keen to be something. A regiment without tradition is far better than a regiment with tradition, because the one without it is trying to make it. The one that has already got it tends to live in the past. That is my opinion. I was fortunate. Very quickly, I was earmarked. Christmas of that, December of that year, 1942, I was earmarked to go to the Bombay on the Dock Ferrying Party. This was quite an experience, because we had to go on board all the big merchantmen. We had passes to go on any ships that flew the Red Duster, and to inspect equipment such as tanks, lorries, guns. And there was different parties. There was an RAF party there who unloaded aircraft coming into India, which was the arsenal for the British in that part of the world. We would unload jeeps, and on each Liberty ship that came in, American Liberty ship that came in, there would be 600 of these jeeps stacked on the main deck in cases. And the cases were the most beautiful made cases, all beautiful timber, all lined with silver paper, and inside was a jeep. And we had to supervise the Indians, the stevedores, to unload these things onto the dockside. And I often think how ludicrous it was. There was me, 20 years of age, who'd hardly ever seen a ship apart from coming out, trying to tell, order Indians who had possibly 20, 30 years of unloading cargo onto Bombay docks. We had the convoys used to come in at the beginning of the month, and we had a month to turn it round, to unload it and get it ready for sailing back to wherever it was going. And we used to work, we had day shifts and we had night shifts. But all day and all night, Bombay Docks was loading and unloading tanks, guns, lorries, aircraft. And the aircraft used to come in big cases, and they were just unloaded straight onto Queen Mary trailers, taken to an airfield outside of Bombay, I'm not quite sure where now, where they were unpacked, assembled, and flown away. And most of it was done with Indian labour. On Bombay docks, we had these tanks coming in. We would supervise the unloading of them. There was an Indian electrical mechanical engineer unit who came to inspect for saltwater damage and things like that. And then we would take them to a railway siding, load them up on railway flats, and they would be taken up to Kirkley Arsenal, where all the paperwork and so forth and so on. And then we had the job later, at a later date, to see the same vehicles come back to Bombay and loaded back on the same merchantman and taken across the top of the Red Sea through the canal, Suez Canal, to reinforce the Eighth Army. All the tanks and things like that were just coming in just to be inspected, to put it made in a workable order, and to make sure they were in a workable order, because most of them were brand new anyway. And then off they would go. We transported lorries, whole convoys of lorries, from Bombay over the Western Ghats to Kirkley Arsenal. But none of the tanks and things like that were being issued to units in the in India, and most of those few that was left behind were the outdated Lees and Grants, all the Shermans, and a few Valentine's Matildas were being left behind at Kirkley, but not very many. And most of it, as I say, was just transit in transit to the Middle East. I liked this. It was something I'd never done before. We was virtually free of petty army disciplines. We had a job to do. We knew how to do it and what to do. And thoroughly enjoyable. And in free time, we had all the enjoyment of Bombay. You could go swimming in beach candy. You could go down to the big metro cinema, which was air-cooled. Occasionally, we was invited by the Indian Railways to a supper, and life was good. I was quite prepared to spend the rest of the war in Bombay, but...
And this was in the monsoon, presumably?
In the monsoon? No, no. Oh, well, the monsoon, I mean, that didn't matter to us at all in Bombay, because we just worked as normal. We had a job to do, supervising and unloading all arms coming into India, supervising the loading of them onto railway flats to be taken to Kirkley Arsenal. What they did with them there, I'm not quite sure, but every so often there would be a long train with the same tanks returned back to Bombay, where we would load them on another merchant ship, where they were transported across the Indian Ocean down through the Suez to the Middle East. So all we were was really a big base depot for the Middle East. And as I say, I got there December 1942, because I remember sitting down at the gateway of India on the first, for the new year, 1943, and all the ships in the harbour blew their sirens and things like that. And shortly afterwards, a matter of weeks, perhaps a month or so, it came in our orders in the depot that we was attached to, that all 25th Dragoons, 26 Hussars, would be returned back to their parent unit. In my case, the 26th Hussar. By that time, the 26th Hussar had been fully equipped with Lee and Grant tanks, and had shifted, left Naira, and gone to Secunderabad. And they were out on the big training area of Balaram, Alair. And it was there I was returned back to. I rejoined the unit to be given a tank, to take over a tank. In a very short period of time, we were officially told we were going on active service. We had to bomb these tanks up. Lorries after lorries came and loaded with ammunition. 7.5, 3.7, hand grenades, you name it. We had to belt up all the ammunition that's placed inside a tank. And we was given green battle dress, so we knew where we were going. We weren't going to the Middle East. We were definitely going to Burma, which we'd received no training. As far as I know, we had no training to go for jungle warfare. And after we'd finished it, The tank transporters arrived, we loaded up, and we was taken back to Secunderabad. And as we came off the transporters, there was a sergeant of the Indian Electrical Mechanical Engineers with a clipboard. He said, "Sign here, driver, your regiment's disbanded." I said, "I don't talk rot." I said, "We're going to war." "No," he said, "your regiment's disbanded." With that, all the officers disappeared. The cookhouse and all the rest of it still worked. And after about 3 or 4 days, the colonel turned up, and he was virtually in tears. He said that his regiment was disbanded as reinforcements to the Carbineers, who were down in Madras, and those people who had any infantry experience would be going to LRPGs, which eventually became the Chindits, long-range penetration columns, groups. And I was one of those chosen to be posted to the Carbineers. We polished and we cleaned, we loaded, we unloaded, and eventually 66% of us was posted to the Carbineers and transported to Madras, a place called Trivalur, which was under, virtually under 2 foot of water. A tidal wave had come up the river at Madras and flooded most of the surrounding area, and many, many hundreds, if not thousands of Indians had been drowned. We were welcomed to the 3rd Carbineers. I was welcomed to the C Squadron 3rd Carbineers, allocated a tank, which we bombed up. We loaded once again with 7.5 ammo, 3.7 ammo, belted all the ammunition, virtually the same tanks as we'd handed back in from the 26th SAR. We were loaded up and we transported those same vehicles right across the subcontinent of India, across the great Brahmaputra River, up to a place called Dimapur. And it was here that the country was so different to anything we'd ever seen in India. Instead of being flat and arid, it was green and mountainous. And the thing I always remember about going over the hill, over the mountains to Imphal, was the fact that you sat in the back of a lorry, and when you're on the flat, the country runs away from you. It disappears away from you. But when you're in mountainous country, it looms at you. It's building up all the time, and it makes you bilious. The only way to stop that was to cover your head over and not look at it. We went through the place called Kohima, which became very famous. It was then, when I passed through it, was a convalescent camp, Red Cross, or most of the huts and bashes had big Red Crosses on them. And we made our way over the mountains, and of course Imphal stands about 6,000 feet above sea level in a valley, and it's one of the most beautiful places that you will ever see. It's green, it's lush, it's got river running through it, and mountains, vast mountains on both sides. Anyway, we came down into the valley of Imphal, and we went to a place called Yaripok. This Burmese village, alter that. It wasn't a Burmese village, it was a Manipuri village, because Imphal is the capital town of the state of Manipur, which was an independent state. We went to this village of Yaripok, and we took over the village exactly as the Manipuris had left it, had been forced out of it. And we started training, mountain climbing and all that sort of thing. Then all of a sudden we were picked up, loaded up, and very quickly taken back to Imphal. And we took over a place at the 108 milestone north of Imphal. The whole regiment was there. The squadrons were dispersed in various areas, but the whole regiment was there about 108 milestone. And we was there. And while the one thing that stands out in my memory of that particular area was that Stainless Stephen came and entertained us.
Who?
Stainless Stephen, a very famous comedian of his day, been dead many years now. And he came with a band, an Indian band, and sat there and entertained us. He sang to us and laughed with us and all the rest of it.
Did he create a good impression?
Oh, indeed, very, very much so. Because we had very little in the 2 years or so that I was in Burma. Entertainment was virtually nil. We had Noel Coward came. I'll tell you about him in a minute. But Stainless Stephen came, and he was one of the very few acts that I personally saw. And at that time, there was rumours, many, many rumours, that the Japs were coming. Mountbatten was going to come, and eventually he did. He turned up, and we were told that we had to put on our best bib and tuckers. We would hide ourselves away, and that they put a trumpeter on a piece of high ground so that when Mountbatten's entourage arrived, the trumpeter would sound barrack field alarm, and we would all rush out as though we were very pleased to see this high-ranking individual. But after we'd sat there for about 4 hours awaiting his arrival, we weren't in the best of spirits. But we had to rush across and make out that we were so pleased that he'd come to see us. Anyway, he was a sort of chap. He told every regiment, as far as I know, the same patter. He had the same patter for every regiment, even Indian ones. It was only good regiments he'd chosen to be in his 14th Army. And we weren't going to run away no more. We were going to stay. And he would feed us by air. He kept his promise, to be quite truthful. And he was the sort of man that appealed to the average soldier. He could talk to the average soldier in the sort of language that the average soldier understood. Anyway, he said his bit and in his jeep, and he was gone. And then the regiment started to disperse. Different squadrons had to take up different positions on different sides in Infal. My squadron, C squadron, we were left on the northern side of Infal. A squadron went down to the Bishanpur area, which was south, and another one went out on the eastern side, out of the three fighting squadrons. And HQ squadron stayed in what they called a box. We formed box, and it was a square-sided defensive position. And we had our infantry next door, we had our own tanks, and then we'd have another infantry battalion and so forth and so on. And we formed what they called box. And the box that which it was HQ was known as Oyster Box. HQ squadron stayed there. The one that stands out in my memory was the one that we was in, which was known as Lion Box. And these various boxes were scattered around, and each night you went back into these boxes and formed a defensive box. And then the RAF and the Americans used to come across the top of these boxes and drop our supplies. And it, as history tells you, it worked. But my squadron, C squadron, we had the job of patrolling the Infal Dimapur Road. They told us nothing. We didn't know anything. All we knew was the Jap was going to come. When or how or where, we didn't know. We were told nothing. But our job as C squadron, we had to patrol the road. And of course, there was a continuous stream of traffic, either going or coming. And on the day that stands out in my memory was that my troop, 7 troop, we had the job of going up to the first line of communication. Now, over this very mountainous country, the Indians, who were virtually bringing the supplies up from Dimapur over to Infal, were losing so much equipment by driving lorries over the side of the Cud, and everything, the driver was lost, the lorry was lost, and its contents was lost because it was many thousands of feet and it couldn't be recovered. That the rumour was the Americans, who were supplying most of this equipment, threatened to stop supplies to that part of the world. And so the Americans took over the railways from Calcutta to Dimapur. A railway, an American railway regiment took it over, and different units took over the actual supply routes from Dimapur to Imphal. Our job was to make sure this route was kept open. My troop, we went off, and our orders were to go to the first line of communication post and return. And it seemed funny that all of a sudden there was no traffic. It had all gone. My troop leader, my troop officer, didn't seem to be too worried about it. And so we carried on. When we got to the first line of communication post, they were all dead. The Jap had come down. There were, I suppose, about 12, 14 military policemen. All had been taken quite unawares, and they were all dead. I think it was the fastest move that certainly my troop ever made. We not only turned round double quick fast, but we didn't go into it because they were all dead anyway. There's nothing we could do. And the wireless communication was so bad because of the mountainous regions that it was difficult to get in touch with anybody or to do anything. So the troop officer, Lieutenant Roe Wilson, had to decide for himself what action he was going to take. He decided it was best to leave, which we did, double quick time. As we turned round and brought our 3.7 gun to the rear, a military policeman came out of the jungle, still had his red hat on. And we opened the sides of the door and dragged him in. And we took him back to a place called Kanglatombi, which was a big ordnance supply base, possibly the biggest in the Imphal Valley. Everything that 14th Army or 4 Corps of 14th Army had had. Everything was there, from beer to uniforms to D8s, D4s, petrol, you name it, it was there, lock, stock and barrel. And it was manned by, I believe, my figures might be wrong after all these years, but there were somewhere about 20 to 25,000 Indian non-combatants who worked this huge place. They were members of the Indian Ordnance Corps, the Indian IEME, Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, sappers and miners, all what we would have classed then as non-combatants. We dropped this military policeman there at one of his posts. He never uttered a sound. He never told us what happened. We picked him up. He sat there quite silent, and we dropped him. And that was the last I ever saw him. When we got back to 108 Milestone, where the squadron was, there was a big flap. There was tank transporters there. They were loading up, and they were doing a hasty retreat. We knew somewhere that the Jap was in the vicinity. What they looked like, what they were, we didn't have the faintest idea. Nobody had ever told us. Anyway, all we knew was that on rumours that Japs were only little men with big buck teeth and all wore big glasses. That is very, very untrue. Anyway, we returned quickly, loaded our kit,